From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In 2002, U.S. forces captured 15-year-old Canadian-born militant Omar Khadr during a raid on an al-Qaeda camp in Afghanistan. Badly wounded during the raid, Khadr spent time recuperating at Bagram Air Base, where prosecutors say he confessed to, among other things, planting landmines and killing an American soldier with a grenade, all of which earned him a trip to Guantanamo Bay, where he was deemed an enemy combatant and charged by the United States with murder. Khadr's military tribunal is now underway, but his defense attorneys argued recently that his confession should be thrown out because, they say, it was coerced. To help make their case, they called as a witness the alleged coercer, identified in court as Interrogator 1. Now, according to the ground rules for reporters covering such tribunals, anonymous witnesses cannot be named. So, when three Canadian journalists and the Miami Herald's Carol Rosenberg did just that last week, they were barred by the Pentagon from further coverage of any and all trials at Guantanamo. Rosenberg is the most veteran of all reporters covering Gitmo, which raises the question, why would she break the rules? She joins me now. Hey, Carol, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Bob.
Okay, before we get to the particulars of your dispute with the Pentagon here, I want to talk for a moment about this ex-soldier called Interrogator 1.
Interrogator 1 was the first soldier to interrogate Omar Khadr, and he did it within 2 weeks of his being captured. This 15-year-old Canadian shot through the back and out the chest and blinded in one eye with shrapnel. And he said that his was a clean interrogation, that he followed all of the rules that were available to him at the time, and that he disputed Omar Khadr's claim that Omar Khadr was threatened with rape.
Didn't threaten him with rape, but told him a cautionary rape tale, right?
What he said was he told him a story, a fictitious story, about an Afghan kid of similar circumstances who didn't help his interrogators, and in the end, he was raped and died. He said he just told him a story about another boy's rape.
Now, the reason I know about this guy and know his name is he gave an interview in the Toronto Star back in 2008, and in that interview freely discussed the Khadr case, more or less a sneak preview of his testimony at Guantanamo May 5th. Is that about right?
Yes. He sought out the Toronto Star reporter, who is reported most on the case of Omar Khadr, and he said, I'm interrogator number one, and I want to clear my name. And then he proceeded to give her an on-the-record interview with his name attached. So I, in 2008, learned his name the same way you did. Fast forward 2 years, and I'm sitting at Guantanamo, and interrogator number one is coming to testify. And so I included a single paragraph in my article that said, Interrogator number one has been identified in the Canadian media as Sergeant Joshua Klaus, who was subsequently court-martialed for detainee abuse not involving Omar Khadr. That's what I wrote.
You were in a weird sort of bind because although you did know his name and it had been made public, you had also agreed to Pentagon ground rules strictly forbidding you from naming anonymous witnesses. And when he testified, he was testifying anonymously as Interrogator 1.
We have always been allowed to insert outside information into our stories. We have always been allowed to say what other newspapers in other countries reported about Guantanamo. And I will tell you that in week 3 of the detention center's existence, the same kind of ground rules banned me from naming prisoners. Back then, the detainees were anonymous. But in week 3, I wrote that Australian media reported that David Hicks was in the cages at Camp X-Ray. Nobody considered me importing information that was in the public domain in a newspaper overseas into my article to be a violation of the ground rules. The question is, why is it now?
Let's talk about why the ground rules are there to begin with. Whom or what is the government trying to protect?
Well, the government has good reason to protect these interrogators and to protect security people in the U.S. military. For different reasons, they seek protection for different people. They're concerned that they won't voluntarily testify because if their name is out there, they believe their families could be at risk. They're concerned that they won't be able to redeploy them and call them up back for service because if they put them out into, you know, the combat area, they would be more at risk than any other interrogator or security person. They're concerned that there is no subpoena power for certain people to Guantanamo and that they will not get cooperation from people if they don't believe they can be anonymous.
Sort of a witness protection program at the trial itself.
For sure. But my point is, you protect the secrets you have. But a man who 2 years ago called up the newspaper and identified himself, that's not a secret they're protecting. They're protecting the prerogative to not identify people who are already publicly identified.
All right, fair enough. But in a background conversation with our producers, the Pentagon said that what happens outside of the court has no bearing on the rules within the court, and then you just flat out flouted those rules. Maybe they're worried about setting a dangerous precedent.
Well, I think the editors are worried about setting a dangerous precedent because if this ban continues, it means the Pentagon can reach into newsrooms across America, across the world, and tell editors what previously published information cannot appear under a Guantanamo dateline. They're telling editors, even if you reported it 5 days ago from Washington, D.C., don't put that paragraph under a Guantanamo dateline or you won't be allowed to cover this. Even the Bush administration didn't have this policy. They allowed you to import previously published information under a Guantanamo dateline.
Well, since you invoked the Bush administration, let me invoke the Obama one. Back in 2007, candidate Obama said that he was going to reject the Military Commissions Act that I guess undergirds the Guantanamo procedures and adhere to the Geneva Conventions. And the Cotter trial is the first military commission to play out under Obama's watch. What do you suppose happened?
He went in and worked with Congress and made some changes that he thinks make them fairer. They used to have a rule that said only tortured evidence could be excluded from the trial. You'd have to prove torture. Under the Obama commissions, it has to be a voluntary confession. What they've tried to do is bring them into more alignment with a federal criminal court that you would see in the states. That's what they tried to do.
But
no court in America would tell you only write what happens when you walk through this door. They would say, watch what happens through this door and write whatever it is you think the reader should understand.
All right, let's just say that the Pentagon's ruling is indeed absurd and arbitrary. What do you think is behind this?
8.5 years have taught us that sometimes the Pentagon's understandings of their authority later changed. Remember, at the beginning, they told us that the names of prisoners were protected information, and then the AP went to the courts and they got the names declassified. At the beginning, the Pentagon said they have no right to habeas corpus and that they don't get lawyers. Sometimes understanding of the rules by which we operate at Guantanamo change.
Okay, so maybe they will reverse their decision, but you and these Canadians are among the most inveterate reporters down there. Do you think that anything about this is punitive beyond the case at hand?
I guess what maybe you're asking is whether the people who handle the Guantanamo message don't want experienced reporters down there. And I can say that it does thrive on the confusion and inexperience and ignorance of the people who are first-timers. They have for years brought people down and hoped that they'll tell the same story over and over again. That's why the package tour boasts that they've had hundreds and hundreds of reporters through there. The only way you cover Guantanamo well, I argue, is by going back again and again and covering it when you're not at Guantanamo and reading the files and reading the motions and being prepared before you ever go down there to understand the totality of the story. They want to create the impression that this is battlefield-style justice. You know, you pulled everybody in, stick them in some tents, throw together a court, and have a variation on a court-martial. You know, they have rotations of guards. They have rotations of escorts. Even the lawyers haven't been the same for all these years. The only people who are the same in this instance are the detainees and the reporters. And I don't think that they're necessarily comfortable with the fact that we've logged more hours and perhaps know the history of this case better.
All right, Carol. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Carol Rosenberg is a reporter for the Miami Herald, where she's been covering Guantanamo Bay for 8.5 years. As I mentioned, we talked to a Pentagon spokesman who, because of ongoing negotiations with the Herald, declined to speak to us on the air.
On our Facebook page this week, we've been posting about a slew of criticism directed at Facebook. In recent weeks, consumer groups, privacy experts, lawmakers, and Facebook users have railed against the site's new privacy policy, which makes a user's previously private information more public and accessible to third parties. One big complaint is that Facebook has failed to effectively communicate the new privacy settings and that the changes are incredibly confusing. According to the New York Times, if a user wants to opt out of the new settings and keep his information private, he must, quote, click through more than 50 privacy buttons, which then require choosing among a total of more than 170 options. New York Senator Chuck Schumer has asked the Federal Trade Commission to come up with new guidelines for how social networking sites, including Facebook, treat users' information. The truth is, all of this is uncharted territory. There are very few regulations that relate to privacy on the many technologies we use each day. The laws that do govern the way private companies and government agencies may access and use our private information lag far behind the internet age. Next week, we'll delve more deeply into this topic. We'll talk about the knowns and unknowns of online privacy and some proposed legislation that attempts to define and safeguard our rights to privacy in the age of interconnection.
Coming up, ABC's Sunday morning show, The Week, has decided to formally fact-check its guests. Meet the Press declines.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In December, NYU journalism professor Jay Rosen proposed something simple that was at the same time revolutionary. Why don't the Sunday morning talk shows fact-check their guests? In a blog post, Rosen argued that there was plenty wrong with the Sunday show format, but that fact-checking each show and posting the results online on Wednesday would be a relatively easy way to add a little more accountability to the show's guests, the hosts, and the producers. But when Meet the Press host David Gregory was asked about the idea, he said that fact-checking would not be incorporated into his show, saying, quote, "People can fact-check Meet the Press every week on their own terms." A week later, two college students took Gregory up on his offer and launched the website Meet the Facts. Paul Breer, a political science student in Kansas, and Chaz Danner, a journalism student at the New School in New York City, combed through each episode of Meet the Press, list all of the asserted facts on their website, get help from other like-minded students of truth, and eventually label the statements as true, mostly true, half true, or false. Chaz Danner, one of the founders of Meet the Facts, joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Give me an example of non-fact or, lie that you've come across.
Last week, Mike Pence made some statements where—
This is the congressman from Indiana?
From Indiana, yeah.
Let's listen to what Mike Pence had to say.
Yeah, the so-called stimulus bill that has taken us from 7.5% unemployment to nearly 10% unemployment nationwide.
So what was your take on that statement?
So he's using the right numbers there. He's actually a little bit off, but he used it to suggest that unemployment is now worse because of the stimulus bill. USA Today did a survey of economists where they agreed that, in fact, the stimulus bill had cut the unemployment rate, that it would be much worse, in fact, if it hadn't been passed. And the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan organization, said the same thing.
Now, there are other people in the fact-checking business already. They're nonpartisan, apolitical. I'm talking about PolitiFact, for example. You guys are both Democrats, and I wonder whether your fact-checking will be deemed, you know, nonpartisan enough to be taken seriously.
Well, you know, I mean, that's certainly a problem, and that's one of the reasons that we were very much out in front about that and say, you know, we're Democrats. You don't have to Google us and find out. I don't personally believe that it's possible to have no bias, but I certainly believe that you can do your work in a way that you disregard your bias. Facts are just facts. All we can do is say we show our work. These are the links that we use. This is how we came to this conclusion. If people are going to disagree with us, then there's nothing we can do about that.
Now, I understand that you're planning to show the time spent on each particular fact that you're checking.
As a way of explaining that, no, really people can't do this on their own terms. They need journalists to be doing this work.
But it also tells me that you're spending a lot of time checking facts, trying to go to school. Do you plan to devote the rest of your life to make sure that David Gregory's guests and Gregory himself get it right?
I wish I could talk to David Gregory or Betsy Fisher, the executive producer, and make a case for what we're doing. If they ever agreed to do it, we would just give them all of our stuff. We'd give them the website. We'd give them the usernames. It's not my life's calling to fact-check Meet the Press forever, I don't think. But if it turns into a permanent counterpoint to Meet the Press, so be it. We don't want that to be the case. We want them to change course. But it's something that needs to be done.
Now, NBC declined our request to discuss this subject, but they did give us a statement. One of the core missions of Meet the Press is accountability, and we take that responsibility very seriously throughout an interview and in our preparation. In addition, we always welcome viewers and media monitoring groups to join the conversation by visiting our website or downloading our app, where we post the transcript after the broadcast.
They're suggesting that their job ends with releasing the transcript. You know, we just think it's their responsibility to confirm that people are being truthful on the show.
Meet the Press's reputation with David Gregory and before him with Tim Russert hinged largely on its willingness to confront guests and question their statements and sometimes, you know, come up with a real gotcha.
That certainly is, I think, the brand identity of Meet the Press in a lot of ways. That's why it makes even less sense that they wouldn't want to do something like this. I mean, imagine the end of the show where they say, okay, just as a reminder, everything you've heard, we're going to look into. If somebody said something that wasn't factual, you know, we're going to let you know about it. Or even part of the broadcast the next week, there's so many different ways that getting this information would be beneficial to the program.
Well, Chaz, I appreciate your spending the time with us.
I appreciate it as well. Thanks a lot.
Chaz Danner studies journalism at the New School in New York City. Jake Tapper is the interim host of This Week, ABC's Sunday morning public affairs show. When he heard about the idea, he decided to embrace it. So at the beginning of last month, This Week partnered with PolitiFact, a fact-checking organization funded by the St. Petersburg Times, to check the guests' statements after each show and then post them online during the week. For example, PolitiFact looked at a statement Bill Maher made criticizing America for not switching to cleaner energy.
I mean, Brazil got off oil in the last 30 years. We certainly could have.
PolitiFact slapped Maher's statement with a label of false because Brazil, it turns out, is seventh in the world in oil consumption. Another example, president of BP America, Lamar McKay, was asked about a letter his company sent to a government agency before the Gulf disaster, a letter arguing that no additional safety regulations were necessary. BP's McKay said, no, the letter
actually recommends improvements and specific recommendations around safety regulations, so we're not fighting anything about safety.
Tapper says he knew that wasn't right, but depended on PolitiFact to give it a barely true rating after the show.
I wasn't about to spend 5, 10, 20 minutes, especially because I think at that point in the interview, I only had about 2 minutes left, disputing this when it was just a he said, he said at that point. I said this, he disputed it. We actually had a referee come in later. It's a great way to enhance a viewer's understanding of these issues and also for somebody to actually, I don't want to compare what we're doing to the marriage ref, but to have a winner. Somebody is actually correct and somebody is actually incorrect.
Well, I don't know about you, but I kind of lay awake at night imagining some sort of fact-checking machine that tells me in real time
whether someone has just handed me a line of bologna.
The best possible world would be if on live television you could have a situation like on the old VH1 show Pop-Up Video. Senator Smith comes out and says, Elena Kagan did this. And all of a sudden, whoop, you know, you see this visual on the screen saying, Elena Kagan never did that. That's false. Unfortunately, it's just not possible. It can't be instantaneous. Now, my job as the host is to push back and challenge if somebody says something that's not correct. Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, came on this week on Sunday, and he had said that Abdul Muttalib, the failed Christmas Day Detroit bomber, was Mirandized after 20 minutes. Now, I said,
my understanding is that actually after about 50 minutes, they had to take him to get medical care, and that's why he stopped talking then, because his life was in danger.
But that's about as close as you can get to a fact check on live television, I think. But fact checking actually is a lot more difficult than people think it is. People think that it's often just these simple matters of Senator Smith said that day is night, and obviously day is day. It's often a lot more confusing and a lot more complex than that.
As you say, one of the complications of fact-checking politicians is that the way politicians lie is frequently with nominal facts. They're just simply taken out of context in such a way as to be entirely misleading. How's PolitiFact handling that sort of structural problem?
Well, one of the great things about PolitiFact is that they understand that it's not just true or false. They have standards of true, mostly true, half true, barely true, false, pants on fire lie. Lamar McKay, the president of BP America, they rated his comment about that letter barely true, meaning it was spin, although there was a kernel of truth in the spin, but still essentially not true.
In order for this to have a kind of chilling effect on liars, people have to actually see the assertion made on your show and then go sometime later in the week to the website. Do you have any idea what kind of traffic you're getting at the website a couple days after the broadcast?
I don't, and I will be looking into it. We've only been doing it for about 4 weeks. People need to know about it and learn about it. Whatever the numbers are, they will probably be significantly less than the viewership of the show. That doesn't mean that what we put there is any less important. It just means that it's generally for slightly more engaged viewers.
Well, for the chilling effect to work, I guess you don't need a gigantic audience. None of the Sunday public affairs shows have large audiences. I guess it only matters that if someone were to be caught telling a whopper, he or she would know that it would be trotted out in the next campaign and used against him or her.
I think it was Winston Churchill that said that a lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is still putting on its shoes. And that was in the days before internet, before cable. I don't think that there's any chance that something like PolitiFact, which has existed for years, or factcheck.org, is going to stamp out lying. But I do think this is an effort to create more accountability for the public officials that come on our show. And most importantly, Bob, this is for the people who are frustrated with turning on these shows and hearing lies and not hearing the hosts of the show, the anchors, the reporters, stand up for the truth. It's a step in the right direction, and we can keep building on it. Maybe someday that pop-up video technology will be available, and we can whoop and call them out.
So if someone comes on the show and makes the lie-a-tron go off like you're shoplifting a leather jacket from the mall, will they not be invited back?
That's a great question. There are lots of different kinds of lies in politics. We'd have to discern the intent, how much the person meant to kill the truth. But it also depends on the level of, there have been presidents who have been famous liars. Does that mean that we wouldn't have them on the show?
Well, let's talk about Dick Cheney, for example. You know, he continues to talk about the relationship between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda, and as if he was just utterly oblivious to the fact that that has been long since disproven. So, you know, what do you do with a character like this who continues to trot out the same canards?
Without specifically getting into any one guest, let me just say, politicians who don't want to be challenged tend to find interviewers who are willing to provide that forum for them. I think it's fair to say that somebody who is a big liar probably wouldn't be comfortable with me interviewing them.
Jake, once again, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bob.
Jake Tapper is the interim host for ABC's This Week.
Iran's dissent-racked election last summer, the regime cracked down on information getting out of the country, and the world's attention turned to the role played by Iranians worldwide who spread the news online. Users in countries with uncensored internet created what are called proxy servers, through which people in Iran could reroute their internet service. From his home in San Francisco, a young programmer named Austin Heap turned his blog into a clearinghouse for information on which proxies were operational and which weren't. Within 24 hours, he was getting 2,000 connections per second from users in Iran. "My servers are melting," he wrote in an article for Salon. Soon after the election furor died down, Heap began to work on new anti-censorship software specifically for Iran called Haystack. When someone in Iran uses Haystack to access the internet, the program encodes the information and hides it inside other innocuous content. For example, a dissenter's email might be disguised as a visit to weather.com, or a page on the New York Times' website, which is blocked in Iran, might be camouflaged within the pixels of a family photograph. After months of testing, Haystack has been released to human rights activists, journalists, and other high-risk users in Iran. But Heap says this is just the opening salvo in what is likely to be a long battle of technical wits with Haystack's enemies.
It's always going to be a cat-and-mouse game. Haystack is the first anti-censorship tool to A, encrypt and protect the data, and B, hide it. I do expect them to attempt to reverse engineer the software and try to come up with ways to block it. And what we have done is come up with a roadmap for our next series of steps. So once there is something that potentially could block Haystack, we're ready to move to the next strategy and the next one.
How are you going to distribute it once it opens to wide release? If a person tries to download it from the internet, they could get caught unless you plan on hiding it inside of an innocent family photo.
We can't just post Haystack online. There are a lot of risks associated with doing that. The regime, for example, could spoof haystacknetwork.com. Let's say you were in Iran, you would have no way of knowing if you're actually connecting to the real Haystack website.
Yikes.
One of the things we have to do is come up with ways to distribute Haystack physically and rely on a person-to-person network so that, you know, friends can give it to other friends. We want to rely on the trust. I mean, if you remember how Google Mail first came out, it was invite only. So you had to know someone to get an invite. And we hope that that will be an effective way of distributing it.
So you're talking about in real life, flesh to flesh contact to get this stuff around.
You know, we have to rely on old world means to open up the new ones.
Couldn't criminals use Haystack to hide their nefarious doings online?
There's definitely a legitimate concern. The way the network is built is to protect the user from us and us from the user. So we never know what they're doing, and we never know who they are. And that's risky because somebody could plan some, as you mentioned, nefarious activity. But we believe that having the chance of free speech is better than not having it at all. And you're always going to have a few bad apples, if you will.
But it would be so easy for terrorists who are planning things to hide the really important chatter that government intelligence agencies listen in on by tucking them into a Haystack camouflage program.
Haystack would make it easier for them, but I mean, there's plenty of good ways to communicate securely, and I don't think that, you know, Haystack is going to severely bolster their toolbox, if you will.
Since Haystack won approval for export to Iran last month, you've received a fair amount of press, not just from the Western press. Four out of the six state-run Iranian newspapers have tried to paint you as a U.S. spy and also as immoral.
If you look at what they put out about activists, it's always that they're a spy. It's always that they're immoral. You know, it's the same old story.
But they're making a big deal out of your being gay. This is supposed to hurt your credibility as a programmer or anti-censorship fighter.
I think it's really weird that somebody has pored through my Facebook profile in order to write state-run media news stories. I think that they're trying to scare people, that they're trying to find any reason to keep people from sharing their story, and they'll use any ammo that they can get.
The state-run newspapers are giving Haystack a lot of free publicity.
That's also true. I haven't thought about that yet, so I guess I should say thank you.
Do you think Haystack ultimately will be exported beyond Iran?
Definitely. If you look at the percentage of people who have access to the internet, 31% of them live under some form of government-imposed censorship. So our job doesn't just end at Iran. It just is starting with Iran. We do expect copies of Haystack to end up in other countries, but the way our network is set up, unless you're connecting from an address within Iran, we won't accept that connection. That's not to say that we're not looking at the next country. We're already working on, I can't tell you which one yet, but we've got number 2 and number 3 underway, and we hope to announce all that soon.
Austin, thank you very much.
Thank you, too.
Austin Heap is Executive Director of the Censorship Research Center.
Coming up, a peek into our near technological future. Students of cyberspace show off their amazing inventions.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. If colors were musical notes, this is how painting would sound.
This is the sound of red paint. This is the sound of yellow paint. This is the sound of violet. This is the sound of green. And blue.
It was just one of dozens of school projects at what may be the nation's coolest science/art fair, New York University's Interactive Telecommunications Program, sometimes described as the center for the recently possible. Here, using the latest tools, the students are building stairways to cyberspace, and with each successive class, bringing the real and virtual worlds closer and closer together, NYU's 2-year program turns out crops of theorists, programmers, and artists intent on better living through computer science.
My name is Adi Maram, and my project is Short++. And I was always the shortest kid in the class, and I decided to come up with a solution to solve this problem. So basically, these are elevator shoes that I control with an iPhone application. So whenever I want to be tall, I just press a button and I change my height.
I am Mustafa Baratlı, and this is my project. It's called Poker Face. It's a personal mood coach. I'm using 2 different sensors. One of them is a heart rate monitor, and the other one is galvanic skin response, which is on my wrist. So these are detecting the changes in my mood. And if there's anything changing, it's changing the color of the screen in here. So you know how I'm feeling by just looking at the color. Also, it's vibrating, so I'm able to see if there's any change in my mood. So if I was about to say something mean to someone, and if I was angry, and I feel like it's vibrating, so I can stop myself and not say it.
So for people who have impulse issues, they can see exactly when trouble is brewing before it starts.
Exactly. I mean, that was my inspiration, actually. I needed to stop myself somehow, and I started building this. Also, I have a visualization, so you can just go through your day and see the pictures and the sensor graphics and then identify what's changing your mood. You can see the people in the pictures, and if they're affecting you, you can ignore them in your life. The other thing that you can see in this application, this is my Google Calendar. And, for example, Sunday, May 2nd, you can see I'm having a breakfast. I'm okay. But then I came to ITP. That was before my thesis presentation. I was really nervous, and it's all the way up. So I feel like this is pretty accurate to see all this stuff.
So right now, is your monitor on?
Yeah, it is on.
It goes from a slightly rose color to a slightly white-ish color.
White, the pure color, that means that I'm calm. But a little pinkish color, that means I'm a little excited, I guess. And in this situation, I'm assuming that I'm a little excited because ITP show and I'm done with school. So, you know, I'm having fun in here.
But taken together, the students' projects extend far beyond themselves. They've taken on and intend to conquer a world crammed with unsorted, unfiltered, unmanageable info bits. You want to know what the world cares about and when it cares about it? With technology that can collate and correlate internet searches and media coverage, the zeitgeist can be read with the same precision as Mustafa's heart rate.
My name is Zoe Fradblinar, and this is a project called Currents. And Currents is basically a meme tracker. It's going through what is it that America has been interested in the last 24 hours. So, for example, starting about 1 o'clock, everyone really wanted to know about Lena Horne's death.
And there's layers upon layers, like this is the epidermis. But what's the significance of the little orange circles, the medium-sized pink circles, the big green circles, and so on?
Each of these circles is a news item. So every time you see a circle inside this information stream, that's a successful news item. That's a time when someone wrote an article and it created interest or it piggybacked off of interest. Every time that we see some circles outside, it was unable to fertilize a meme. They were unsuccessful news stories. So, for example, Gulf winds turn against BP. No one cares anymore. It's over. There is no interest. I watched that meme go by days ago. The color of the meme is linked to how saturated with news that meme is. So if you're a journalist, you want the latest color memes, the memes that no other journalist has thought to cover yet. On the other hand, if you have a huge meme, very dark colored, like Alicia Etheridge, don't bother covering this meme. It's already saturated.
I see. So this is potentially a guide for journalists looking for hot stories that haven't yet achieved saturation.
Very much so.
Do you have any qualms about this technique and what its impact might be on media coverage? For instance, if somebody says, well, they shouldn't be covering the new nominee for the Supreme Court because it's already saturated, would that prevent people from maybe finding out important news that just hasn't made it on the board?
On the contrary, I think actually what this would help news media to do is to choose which topics that are sensational they can cover to get the most amount of traffic, and that's going to free up time and resources for more important coverage. If instead of covering every celebrity scandal, you just cover the one that's going to get you that same amount of people, think about how many people could be covering Greece. It's not your percent of soft news that goes up, it's just the quality.
Clay Shirky has a threefold role in the Interactive Telecommunications program. He helps run the mechanics of the students' theses, the final projects I've been walking through. He teaches the theory and practice of social media. And recently, he's helped to launch a partnership with UNICEF, in which students work on projects that involve social media for development organizations. Currently, he's excited about an application that's deceptively simple and obvious, and yet never employed before to save families.
The application is called Rapid FTR, and FTR is the Development Community's acronym for Family Tracing and Reunification. When a disaster strikes, whether it's an earthquake or a civil war, it's really in the few hours to few days after the disaster, after the separation, that is really the golden hour. That's the time at which you could intervene and reunite these families. And yet the current system for managing that involves, I kid you not, loading carbon paper onto planes and flying it there. And the students said, it doesn't have to be this way. So they've designed a system. It works on mobile phones. It works on laptops. It works on netbooks, which makes it simpler to take a child's picture, record their information, and simultaneously send it to the local office, send it to the national office, send it to the international office, whereas before with paper it had to go in several steps, and just speed up the information gathering part of family tracing and reunification. And UNICEF looked at that in December when they came to critique the class, and they said, this is very interesting, thank you so much, but there was a sense of, oh, someday we could have something like this. Then they catch a guy trying to leave Haiti with several dozen 5, 6, 7-year-old girls, and suddenly the bias went to, can we have this now? Jorge, the student whose thesis it is, said, I'll sign up for that. And Jorge now runs a global team of developers. There are 30 people working on this project worldwide, even before he graduates.
ITP is now in its 31st year.
Yes.
And obviously, it well predates the kind of potential of new media that we've seen in the last 15 years. How has it changed while you've been here?
The thing that made the place what it was in 1979, in the founding year, was Red Burns, our founder and still director, saw the Handycam and public access cable television. And she said, this is it. Media is getting democratized. The number of inputs are expanding. The number of outputs are expanding. And she got the theory right, but it turned out that the handycam and public access television didn't have the practical effect in the world. And she made an incredibly fateful choice that has, I think, ramified to this day, which is we don't care what technology it is. What we're interested in is the expanding range of the possible. So what's changed in the 10 years I've been here is that there was a kind of web and screen-based world of people doing animations, 3D, some of the nascent social networking stuff. And there were these people down the hall working on little chips and sensors and actuators, the sort of physical computing, wearable computing stuff. And those two realms were basically separate. And now I'm seeing them join up in front of my eyes.
That is the future, though, isn't it? I mean, we get closer and closer to that technology, and that technology becomes inseparable from ourselves.
No, that's right. Both the number and proximity of chips around us is continuing to grow. I mean, the whole conversation about digital convergence and we'd all have one device. Do you know anybody who owns one device? I mean, it was clear that the devices were coming together, but they weren't converging. They were mating, right? And there were lots more of them.
I've always been a believer in the one screen theory.
Do you know anybody who has fewer screens now than they used to? I mean, I do an exercise with my students at the beginning of class where we take every CPU in the room and we just pile it up on a table. Every computer, every noise-canceling headphone, every digital watch, every iPad, every phone, and it is a stack of technology layers deep. And I point out to people that in the developed world, we are living in a CPUs per person world, and try to get them to realize that in the developing world, the people for whom we're trying to make appropriate technology, they are in a people per CPU world. But I think the CPUs per person curve is going to continue to rise in the West for the foreseeable future.
That sounds horrible. I mean, just carrying around a huge bag of a
the
bunch of little things.
The chips get smaller and smaller all the time. Eventually, they're going to go into the back of your neck and you won't notice.
You're just going to wear them all. And
wearing them is the second to last step. Embedding them is the last step.
As a matter of fact, you have a great example of that here, Poker Face.
Right. The thing Mustafa's working on is the idea that anything you make measurable, you make controllable to some degree.
He created essentially his own biofeedback system.
Did he tell you what happened in his thesis presentation? He got up and the thing is bright red because, of course, he's got stage fright. This little device he's wearing is showing everybody else. His heart rate is through the roof. He's really nervous. He's sweating. All these kinds of things you can measure off the body. And he goes along and he's giving his presentation and telling us what he does. And he says something funny and everybody laughs. And as often happens when the laugh breaks the ice, he relaxes and immediately the little screen flicks down a dial. We didn't just see him relax, see his face. We also saw the biomechanical measurement say, Mustafa is now more relaxed. So it was so good that it was working in a feedback loop during his presentation as he was talking about the device.
How does the zeitgeist of the ITP change from year to year or over the course of a decade?
Well, the interesting thing is over the course of a decade, you really see the zeitgeist because all the students leave. Anything that stays the same across those groups is really part of the environment, not just part of what the students brought in. So this fusion of the virtual and the real, treating the internet not as an alternative to real life but as an augmentation of it, that is absolutely part of the zeitgeist. That keeps getting deeper and deeper. We see an increasing push towards taking large data sets and visualizing them, surfacing a lot of tacit information. Sometimes that information is it's your heartbeat. Sometimes that information is here's what Google says about the news landscape, whereas here's what the New York Times says about the news landscape. And I think across a number of these projects, that idea of finding that tacit information, whether it's communally held, whether it's held in a database, whether it's held in the body, and turning it into something you can look at or listen to and react to is a big part of the recent theme of taking advantage of something we can know that we didn't used to know.
There is certainly just the explorer's impulse. There's a mountain there. Let's see what's on the other side. Right. But then there's the question of why, aside from just a desire to explore, why these tools? Why this knowledge? Is there some sort of broader goal, or is that sort of along the lines of why were we born?
We would never ask that question.
I would never propose that you pose these questions to your students. It's okay. A horribly disabling question.
Yes, that's why. Now, amongst the faculty, we look at these things and we examine what's going on. I mean, one of the great themes that came out of here in the early part of the decade was this idea of the cityscape and social life as game board, whether it was Fiasco or Dodgeball or these kinds of services, essentially annotating your social life and telling you where your friends and their friends were. It was, it's essentially socially a way to see through walls. Now, amongst the faculty, we recognize when a theme has arrived when independently in four or five different classes, students suddenly start working on urban service design in one way or another. And then we start recruiting people and we start making it a more formal part of the organization. The net result of that, it's very sad, is that the year after a student graduates is generally the ideal year for them to have arrived because we've watched them learn from them and made the program fit their interests better than it did when they got there. So we're always what the faculty knows about the zeitgeist is always a trailing indicator of where the students are at any given moment.
Did you ever read Catherine Hale's article on modes of cognition? Mm-hmm. Hyperattention versus deep attention.
Yes.
She was one of the clearest to say that a lot of the pedagogical biases towards deep attention may just simply be a remnant, and that you can't assume that the fact that you scoot over the web as opposed to stay with a novel for a really long time means that something has been lost rather than simply... Exactly. Right. There's something about skipping across the web and bumping into people, even if you are, like me, utterly untechnical. Right. And I just wonder whether, over the course of the 10 years, you see any global move towards a different kind of creativity.
I think the biggest single change I've seen in the students is in the direction of collaboration. 10 years ago when I came here, most of the biggest rooms were computer labs. And the lounge, what's behind us over here, was mainly the waiting room for you to get access to the computer. And then it turned out that when we emptied out the space, the students would colonize it and start doing more collaborative work. And so the amount of lateral learning, right, people having a question about a physical computing project or a video project or what have you, and not coming to us but going down the hall to their more knowledgeable peers has gone through the roof since I've been here. And the number of collaborative projects, the number of projects that have two and three students working on them. And that's been a function, I think, partly of opening up the space just to allow for the collaboration. And it's been partly that the cultural norms around sharing, particularly in technology, have slowly permeated the general consciousness. What started with open source software 25 years ago, you know, the idea that things should be shareable and interfaces should be open to other kinds of uses has now reappeared in the guise of you know, collaborative work. When students show up here, we say to them in their fall semester, you have to sit in a room in a plenary conversation which Red Burns, our founder, runs, in which a different person is going to get up every week and present their work so that your class can synchronize around a set of conversations. Because somebody who's adept at creating video and someone who's adept at creating tools that make video interactive can make a more interesting project together than either of them could make by themselves. This is one of my great complaints about the rise of the novel as the sacred kind of Western art, as the one shining example of sterling product of single mind. It became sacred only when it became challenged, right? All of these concerns about the novel really only arose when collaborative modes of production started putting themselves forward as an interesting alternative.
So people who despair about the future of education in the digital age, these threats to old modes of creativity, basically, it's not a cliff we're jumping off out there. It's just a new future.
Yeah, from my point of view, education is always a set of trade-offs, right? There's different equilibrium states. You get one thing out of quiet contemplation. You get other things out of noisy collaboration. You know, you need a mix. We're leaving a world where quiet contemplation was the norm. I deal with 25-year-olds and 30-year-olds all the time, and I'm not at all worried. The future they are pursuing, it makes me want to eat my Wheaties, to live as long as I can to see what they make, because they're such extraordinary people.
Thank you so much, Clay.
You're very welcome, Brooke. Thanks very much.
Clay Shirky is an author, consultant, and teacher in NYU's Graduate Interactive Telecommunications Program, or ITP, which held its 2010 spring show this week.
Okay, so my name is Alejandro Kaufman. My thesis project was called Value Propositions. The idea was, if people aren't willing to spend money on content online, why is that? And let's try to get at that answer slightly obliquely by getting them to expend other types of value. So Valet Wall basically demands that you talk to my grandma for 15 minutes on the phone, and then it allows you to access content.
But how could you create content that would make it worthwhile for someone to talk to your grandmother? I'm sure she's a lovely woman, for 15 minutes.
It's never worthwhile to talk to my grandmother for 15 minutes, and that's the point.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Alex Goldman, Lynn Davis, and Peter Henderson, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also find our podcast there or at iTunes. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.